Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm your host, Caden Damiano. This podcast has one mission: help product designers generate massive value for their clients, their companies, and themselves so they can do the work they enjoy the most. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock the true value of design in your work? To help with this, I interview top performers in design, product management, and engineering so you can understand what's valuable to your stakeholders, your bosses, and your customers. So enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. Hey, listeners, I'm pretty sure this is my first guest from the Eastern Bloc. This recording is happening comfortably in the afternoon where I'm at, but my guest, he's staying up till midnight to really get his message out, and I really admire that. Today, my guest is George Saraduc. He's the founder of Etic, which is a spin on the Romanian word for ethic. It's a design community / consultancy that really focuses on helping designers and companies create more ethically designed products that don't exploit their customers and users. Provides a lot of services and workshops and content to help get the word out and to help normalize accessible and ethical design practices. George, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for the invitation. It's lovely to be here and really excited to talk to you.
So George, super pleased to finally talk to you. It's been a few months in the making, and I'm just thank you for your flexibility. How about you introduce yourself to the listener? Just tell them your story, how you got to where you are today and like why you're doing it, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So I'm generally really passionate about technology, and I'm currently working as a principal user experience designer at a company that does product design and product development as a service. We're working with medium and large companies trying to solve their user experience problems if they are either connected to low performance, usability, engagement, and so on. And by being so exposed to a wide range of problems, in my own time, so to speak, I realized the importance of, let's say, having a channel in which we could broadcast a message that is really dear to us, which is the importance to design good products, to make good things in this digital space. After realizing how complicated the problems can get if you're not doing the right thing in tech in general. Even though we were really passionate about moving fast and breaking things, in time I realized how important it is or how nasty things can get when you really break things, or most importantly, when you break people. So that's why I founded a community, to just have a way for expression, for me to broadcast a message in which we would evangelize ethical design and good tech in general.
George, yeah, thank you for that intro. I totally agree that I think the move fast and break things model might work in like early stage startups where you're just trying to deliver value and establish product market fit. But there's a lot of companies now that hit growth stage. They've established product market fit, maybe a little bit of business model fit. And now they're growing, hiring a lot of people, and this like this ethos of moving fast and not putting the like requisite care on quality of the product. And when you say good design, based off like your background and everything, good design means like design that like doesn't hurt people, does no harm. It's like actually a good design, like in the ethical sense, not just like effective design.
Yes, this goes with basically everything on different levels or in any industry. You could use scientific discoveries to either cure a disease or construct or make a new bomb. Mm-hmm. So I think it's almost the same way in the digital space with an important mention. Like up until now, I think everyone was just experimenting in this new space, and the digital world was somehow not considered real or serious enough. And in the early 2000s, we were experimenting with the World Wide Web and doing, I don't know, personal websites, hobby platforms, and so on. And just recently, in the past 20 years, we established businesses and digital products that solely live on this virtual space. So as the industry matures, I think the effects of this digital world got more and more real, to the extent in which we're now almost, let's say, anxious if we don't have our phone or don't check our emails. So it shaped the way in which we're doing work, the way in which we're communicating, the way in which we're relaxing. So we got to be pretty dependent on this technology. So by recognizing something that is so infused in our daily lives and yet somehow so broken in many ways, yeah, I just felt the need to first either educate, then consult or advise, and in the end just offer help, even if it's free. We did that as well with public institutions and so on. So yeah, that's the main rationale behind good design in tech.
Yes, good. Good, for the sake of this conversation, means products that don't exploit like how we are wired. And you've mentioned before that you believe that designers have the power to influence what ideas and tools come into this world. And that's, I think that's becoming more and more true, especially in the digital space, especially post-pandemic, where a lot of companies that have postponed investment in digital channels and experiences, and even like new tech companies that have not pushed the limits on how they deliver value digitally, has made digital product designers specifically
a lot more influential in these conversations. I would say that pandemic has increased our responsibility, right?
Yes, of course. And the interesting part is that as we speak or as we interact with the product design communities across Romania, Eastern Europe, or Europe in general, we see how sometimes professionals can stagnate into, let's say, an ignorant state. I don't mean to use this word to offend any professionals, but just having a set of blind spots, essentially, connected to the impact that their products might have on people. Because they're designed and built to be used by other people that have issues, problems, and that use shortcuts and need something better. So here comes a new product that should essentially solve something in your life. But that doesn't usually come across their understanding. So we have these digital folks, these product people that are not necessarily aware of the responsibility they have in terms of how will they shape their users' behavior, their habits, how will that affect their day-to-day work or even their day. They can either improve their work process or just change it, influence it. And if you're not aware of that influence, how can you design for a specific need or a human, right, that has its weaknesses, its needs? And sometimes the solution is either to just ignore or exploit. You need that, so you'll just pay for it, and we're going to have some upfront conditions and so on that you have to agree with and so on. So, yeah. It's about being just more aware of that responsibility.
So when you are consulting with a company and they hire you pro bono or paid, how do you perform like an audit of their product and like, identify like red flags where they could be potentially like doing something like putting roach motels. Mm-hmm. I think roach motels are one of there's like this website, I think it's like darkpatterns.ui or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you like do like an audit of those dark patterns and say, yeah, I found like 3 roach motels in your product? Like, come on.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. And the interesting part is, so I think here we are opening up a discussion, a really productive discussion around accessibility. And a lot of either companies that want to have products that are as inclusive as possible, or institutions that want to have accessible platforms, like you would have a public service that needs to have a public platform which is open to the public. For example, the vaccination platform in which you could sign up for your vaccine in the pandemic world. The understanding is that you need to tick some boxes in order for your platform, website, or application to be okay, accessible. But sometimes people understand that by just using a high contrast between the font and the background. And they would call that strategy, like the accessibility strategy, and they are done with it. And moreover, we have some general guidelines to follow. But in the same time, if you just tick the boxes, you could end up with a website that's not 100% open to the public. Whether that comes with an accessibility level that refers to language, availability, ease of use, and so on. Usually when someone wants to make their platform as accessible as possible, we tend to look at first to the user base and just identify the potential special needs that pool of users might have. And we're really glad that at least here in Europe, the European Union has put forward some sort of futuristic guidelines in terms of what does public service mean and what's the standard of a digital platform as a public service. You would need to have some things related to accessibility, some things related to ease of use, so not necessarily having big fonts if it's really hard to grasp and you don't know how to use it, or it's out of reach, like you need to install something and then have a plugin installed and so on. It's not that accessible. So it's a really complicated story in which someone wants to make it cheap and just tick a couple of boxes. But if you just sit down and think about the human side of it, you will need to do a lot more. And here's where we come in and just offer help and advice about the tools with which you could build such an accessible platform.
Yeah. And so I was actually had a similar conversation about this topic with a designer at Google named Jonathan Sher. I don't know if you listened to the episode, listener, or George, but what I think, like, the most powerful thing that can be done to normalize the challenging of ethical, unethical practices is to find the terms, right? Now, there's a great website called, like, darkpatterns.org, which has a total, like, vocabulary list. And I'm challenging myself, but, like, I challenge every designer to memorize this so that you can, like, go into a meeting and be like, oh, are we doing, like, a bait and switch here, or are we confirm shaming them here? Are we disguising the ad here? Is this obviously an ad, or is there, like, are we putting, like, a forced continuity on our premium model? Because it makes it really hard to refute, right? Because you can't say, oh, when your trial with the service comes to an end and your credit card silently starts getting charged without warning, like, us not warning them is good for the business so that they we can keep charging them. And yeah. You could say, yeah, but that just seems like kind of like a forced continuity. Like, we're not giving them the choice. And if we don't like how people are taking advantage of free trials, maybe we shouldn't do free trials anymore, which is like what Netflix did. Yeah. And if your product's actually valuable, then you shouldn't be worried about having them opt out. And if people are opting out anyways, then your product might not be worth like a continuing usage.
For now, I think that you could still get away with this, let's say, these patterns. My vision is that as the industry will mature, these interactions will get more and more similar with other industries. Think about the restaurant businesses or transportation, anything, right? So if you would order a pizza and then you would get charged with additional 2 forks or something like that, or for the napkins or something, I don't know, you will refuse to pay essentially, or just write up a complaint or speak to the manager. So the vision here, and I think the improvements could go on so many levels, and one of them, and I think one of the most important, is the regulation part. A decade ago, I was working on some stuff with data management, or the cookie policy, and the legislation was not in place to enforce that on every website. And we were actually working on something similar so that the user would know what metrics are being tracked on that specific platform. And the funniest part is that here comes a new piece of legislation that enforced this across all websites. So you just slap this overlay in which you would ask for permission to track stuff and so on. But you had to do it. It became mandatory overnight. So the dream is to have similar pieces of legislation or or bills to just regulate behaviors or even dark patterns. And we can see that more and more companies either get fined for weird behavior, or they get either brought up in front of public institutions, or just forced to change their ways or their behavior. It's either connected to customer service and so on. So yeah, I think in time, a digital business will have to be, live through a couple of really strict regulations that would protect the user, which in our days is really naive and not really educated. And we really think that almost everything online is for free or should be, right? And we have this false expectancy to just have everything up front and not pay for anything and so on. So things might get either more expensive. Like, for example, for so many years, we used YouTube as a free platform. And now people are bothered by the commercials and here comes the new subscription and so on. I think that's a healthy thing to do. Spotify had that for ages. But just be transparent about it, be upfront, and just be honest with what you're offering. It doesn't mean you won't be able to earn money. It doesn't mean it won't be profitable. It just means you need to be transparent, as other industries have to be.
Yeah, I could imagine if they regulate more of these dark patterns out of existence. I think the cookie policy is a really good example. There's not like a misdirection because in order usually to get people to accept the cookie policy, they'll design like a pattern that misdirects them from opting out and makes it look like the only option is to opt in. I can imagine that like the future is less free trials and less free trials, more ads. There's a Netflix series called Maniac, where basically that was like the dystopian future where like poor people would actually just pay with ads and advertisers would buy their cigarettes or something like that. And then they'd be forced to consume ads in response. And it's not ideal, but I could see it being more fair. It's okay. In order to keep commerce moving, a lot of these dark patterns that made it possible to continue making money after a free trial are illegal now. And now they're like, okay, fine. Then if you want to continue watching this, you just either have to pay or you gotta get ads down the throat to do it.
Yeah. In the same time, I see things evolving in a more positive direction as well. If we could think about the fact that 10 years ago, for example, you didn't have an exciting internet speed on your smartphone, right? You would just have a limited amount of megabytes or gigs. I can't remember, but you had a very limited amount of data plan. So I think in the future, possibly maybe the internet could be some sort of common good or public service. And then indeed, you have to pay for stuff, but maybe in the future, some type of knowledge will be free, will be basically a common or public domain. So I can see businesses thriving on healthy business models, but also people that cannot afford expensive products would benefit from like free stuff. Let's say the Wikipedia of these days, or I don't know, some sort of public service, almost like a free email account, which is always free and guaranteed and stuff like that. So
yeah, funded by the government or something.
Yes, true. In the same time, so we can think about Apple's philosophy, right? They were always upfront with, we have a vision that these products and these digital products have to have a certain quality So that's why the price tag, that's why, so we have a vision, we want to do it this way. If you want an email, if you want a cloud plan or a device, either a physical device or an OS, you have to actually pay for it. But we can guarantee safety, we can guarantee quality, we can guarantee privacy and so on.
Well, and provide a very forgiving service as well. It's really easy to accidentally, like my family, I'll like get transactions for upgrade packs to like iPhone games. And it's really easy for me to be like, nope, didn't mean for that to happen. And they like refund me like really easily. That is good. It doesn't mean they can't like make the chute really greasy, like the slide really greasy for you to pay them, especially with the Apple Card. It makes it super easy. Just attach it. And then whenever you make a purchase, like it just charges the Apple Card. And I've definitely gotten bit in the butt a little bit, but they don't make it impossible for me to recover my money if it was an accident, which I think is like another good pattern, right? Like Amazon, it's not unethical. Like one click ordering isn't unethical. It's super easy. And usually you're getting something you want, but the ability to return something super easy as well. And just having an open policy. And I think that's why things on Amazon are slightly more expensive. I think there is margins built in. If you want to get something with convenience, you might be a few, like $5 more expensive than if you just went to Target. I don't know what kind of like the version of Walmart in Romania or something like that. And actually to add to, you know, your story, I actually for school, I visited the Apple campus, the new one, like the spaceship, and talked to a product design engineer. And he talked about the process of them making their hardware and how they would figure out like the user experience of clicking a keyboard, which is funny because they released the touch bar MacBook like later that year that has like the very shallow Z index and people hated it. But what they would do is they would like physically design the key, they'd test it out, and then they'd be like, nope, redesign it. And then they'd like fly to China, supervise the creation of another prototype key, fly back to the US, test it. And I'm like, oh, don't ever complain about how expensive it is, because they're putting all this effort and value into making sure that the craftsmanship and the hardware is like a top quality, right?
And we have other examples as well, but we can talk about Apple for ages. So how come there's a company that has this philosophy embedded in their culture, their products, and not to mention the product design team, right, across the board, and others just feel that they need to profit or put more emphasis on something else? Again, I feel there's a market for everyone, but we need to be careful with the outcomes. And when exploitation becomes the norm, I think it's a high time we just raise awareness or red flag these behaviors and just talk about them. I don't think it's normal what other companies do with their dark patterns and the exploitation of attention. I think it's really detrimental. If there's anything we could do to just first educate the public, then educate the actual designers working on that, and also educate companies as well as institutions, I think that's a really good start.
Yeah, and I think just whatever you design, just enable choice and then afford have a forgiving UI product that affords recovery. If you're like trying to make, there's a lot of talk about moving fast, breaking things, like, oh, we'll just make one part of the system. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
But if we do this, we also need to have a place for them to manage their data, or we also need a place for them to reverse the consequences of these actions if they don't want this anymore. And they're like, oh, we can just throw it on customer service. Oh, but then that's like another dark pattern, which I think, it's the Roach Motel. You get into a situation very easily. A lot of people have the happy path of a digital service.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But then it's really hard to get out of. Like once you're in it. And I've worked for worked for a company that like makes it really optimized getting into the service, but then if you wanted to get out, you had to call customer service, which was a real mess. We wouldn't invest in self-service recovery products, like parts of the product as well. And I think a lot of, especially a lot of listeners, if someone's listening to this episode right now, they believe all this and they're really trying to do their best to create ethical designs. But I actually want to talk about like how to effectively advocate this, because there's also like a negative, I would say, other side of the spectrum type designer that is not really like advocating for design, but virtue signaling their own ethics. Like they're pushing their ethics. And you see this, there's a lot of designers that will say that something's unethical, but it's really just like their version of ethics. That makes sense. I feel like they're seen as like dogmatic about UX, and then they don't really get a lot of like sway in organizations. And then they just end up hurting the cause of making things more ethical because they can't effectively communicate. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
of course. Yeah. And I saw this in other industries as well, that they're not actually connected to tech. It has to do with the craft and the way in which the industry matures and the way in which thought leaders understand to educate others and spread messages, spread values, and also reward performance. I think in time, so we can draw any parallel here, let's say with the medical industry and the doctors. There's this, let's say the plastic surgeons, right? Those plastic surgeons reconstructing the face of a war veteran, or a plastic surgeon making the boobs or the buttocks, the bottom bigger for a person that does not necessarily thrive after an operation mm-hmm. like that. Like it can either be detrimental to the health and so on. So yeah, I think it's a matter of acting professional, having a set of values. And I think any industry will have this layer of underground, underground designers, people that work with dark patterns, possibly on platforms that trade weird stuff. I don't know. I don't want to name things or products. I don't feel comfortable doing that.
That's fine.
But I guess any industry has their hackers or their shadows.
Yeah, there's, I think like a good example of someone that might see themselves as white hat designer, like an ethical, they might think that they're being ethical, but they're like, I think like always insisting that you trim the margins of a product, right? So I worked for a financial company that helps you finance purchases, but since it's for subprime customers, the price to borrow, I guess not borrow money, but like to, it's like lease to own, like rent to own something. The price of renting something to own is a lot steeper than like a good interest rate on a credit card, even though a credit card could like really like snowball out of control. And so a designer could say, that's not ethical how much we're charging them. And that's where it gets in a gray area, because you're like, isn't it fair that we are servicing a higher risk demographic? We're taking on more risk. Is it unethical to charge someone for a service that they otherwise would not have? And that's like the thought experiment, right? That's where it gets like icky, up mucky, right? Because you could have a like minimum required like stuff, like not, don't use dark patterns. Make sure that it's accessible to 100% of people, or as much people as possible when it comes to like color and type. But like, where does it end though? Because then you start getting into ethical thought experiments of, should our product promote triage of patients, or should it save every patient but makes it less effective?
It's an interesting question, because we can sometimes position ourselves, as you said, as ethical professionals, but in the same time, we are not necessarily 100 committed to the cause. So I think it's down to everyone's comfort zone and limits and life philosophy. We could possibly think about energy consumption and the way in which we are contributing to that. We could possibly think about, I don't know, child exploitation or other types of hard labor. And if we are advertising for companies that contribute to that, and so on. It depends. I think there are numerous problems that can be solved with digital design, and others won't be able to be solved with our skills, but require a rather larger discussion in a much larger group, in your local community or society in general, connected to, I don't know, forms of government, politics, social inequality, discrimination of some sort, and so on. So we can draw a distinction from, I guess it should be connected to our skill set. So these are the problems that I can solve with my skill set, my experience, and the toolbox that I have. And this applies for digital products, technology that should be as close as possible to humans and that should facilitate solving problems and just improving their workflow, their day, their overall mood, possibly just making their day better. And others can just be social, and it would be connected. They would be connected to our personal life, maybe, or our community. I don't know. We can draw a difference. And I think everyone has their limits, their comfort zone, their set of values. It depends. If we talk about the ethical areas of our lives, I think this could go really deep, right? What are we doing with the planet? We are polluting. Are you driving an electric car? How much meat are you consuming each year, and so on? Are you recycling? In the same time, I would encourage everyone to recognize that a 2% improvement in our process, in our workflow, in our life, work-life balance is also more important than doing nothing. And if someone would argue that 2% is too little, why not 10%? I would just put more emphasis on the positive change. Like, maybe today we're ready to change two of those dark patterns that you mentioned and just have a discussion with our managers. And tomorrow we'll be tackling something else, and so on. So I believe in progressive improvement and not necessarily critiquing, like, it's either all or nothing. Okay, how are you recycling? Are you pure and zero waste? How come then you're not ethical? So we're humans going through a process. Mm-hmm. And I think that process, if that process is on an improvement path, I think that's good.
Yeah. And honestly, like, I think there is more ethical ways. For example, like Instagram, it's like the new iPhone changes where it actually allows you to block tracking. Doesn't mean that Instagram can't, I would say, optimize their ads, because I think that is like a nice thing to have when you're on like social media. You can get the benefit of like having products that like appear good to you, like a good idea to purchase, like they apply to like your values and stuff. But I just saw this recently that like Instagram asked like, hey, can you fill out a quick survey of what kind of ads you like to see? And I'm like, that's totally ethical. That's okay. Because I could opt into it. I could spend a little extra time. It costs me a little bit more effort as the user, but that's the payment I have to make to get relevant ads on social.
Of course.
And just because it isn't all or nothing. Like a business, like I said, like a business can optimize their conversion funnels, right? To get people to pay them in one way or the other. But it comes, I think, yeah, it comes at a price that we like also need to, it leads to methods that cause more work on the user. And I think one hot take that I say is that putting work on the user isn't always, isn't a question of ethics. It's a question of
maybe, or
yeah, it's a question of responsibility. It's like, how much responsibility do you want to put on your user? If you want to remove like all the friction and stuff, cool. As long as you're not taking away their ability to make a choice, ability to recover, you're not violating their right to privacy. And if it means introducing patterns that require them to do extra work, like the new cookie opt-ins on websites where like you have to go, like you actually have to click in, turn off tracking, and it's a little bit of work, but that's the price we pay for privacy. Don't put it all on the companies to fix it. Like that of needs course. To be like,
and
it needs to be quid pro quo on both sides.
And I don't think the philosophy of making things as easy to use as possible applies 100% of the time. Sometimes you do want to install some kind of friction, mainly to suggest the importance of that thing. Are you sure you want to delete? Type delete in this field to actually erase what you created here. So right now I have to actually spell out the word delete. Yeah, because it's important and you will permanently lose that. So we want to make sure, and it has to be hard for you to commit to it, do it intentionally. So when a thing is has that much importance, you could potentially just signal that and make the user or force the user make a conscious choice. And your example is really relevant. Okay, pick your own interesting items that you want to see as ads or topics or subjects. And yeah, I think it's a good call. I think it's a wise choice.
Yeah, and honestly, I think how we could also make the world more ethical is us being willing to pay for things. Great example of the changes consumers have to make to get access to quality information is journalism, right? When it used to be free and it was all about ad revenue, they'd start being unethical and reducing the quality of their news and their information to get more traffic and to increase clicks and stuff like that. And now, they're also doing another dark pattern, like disguised ads, right? Like they call them native articles. I think you've seen them before where it like talks about the one, there's like a great one that's paid for by Netflix. And it's a journalism piece about the woman in the penal system in the United States. And it's a really cool, interesting, informative article, but it's an ad for Orange is the New Black. Yeah. And it's disguised as, it's an ad disguised as journalism. So you're like, oh, like it might not be super unethical as long as you prominently display, oh, watch Orange is the New Black. But really like, now it's put all good quality journalism behind a paywall. And if you want good journalism, you have to pay for it. And we could kick and scream as consumers for a little bit, but we are not going to improve the quality of journalism in the digital age unless we pay.
Yeah.
And so there's a personal responsibility on us as consumers. If we want, we need to patronize businesses that are willing to be.
Of course.
Ethical.
And we're doing that in other industries as well. I mean, we don't expect free donuts down at the coffee shop merely because, hey, it's local and these are so cheap. How come you're not giving them for free? It's just a stupid example, but simply because the digital space has such a wide variety of content does not mean everything needs to be free and permanently available. You could have layers, and yeah, quality could possibly always be behind the paper wall. Even if you have a free sample of that, like the first 3 to 5 articles are free. You're just free to use. And also, let's take a look at, for example, Sam Harris, He has an app. I think it's the Waking Up podcast and also the Waking Up app.
The meditation.
Yeah. He always says that, okay, it's $20 a year or so. But if you can't afford it, just write to us and we'll analyze, and not necessarily analyze, but you'll get free access if money is an actual issue. So it's really interesting because if I'm San Francisco Bay designer working at Twitter and I want to just clear my head and I see that it's $20 a year, I don't think I will require to have it like free and go through a process in which I would have to say, okay, I can't afford this or it's too much for me, right? So it implies some sort of honesty on your side as well. And I think it's a really good example of how you could just make amends with both worlds.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm personally trying to make an effort to pay apps. Like my macro tracker, like I'll buy the premium version because it's digital, but it's giving me like a service I wouldn't have had. There's engineering and there's IP and like algorithms and design put into the product. Like, and a product isn't good if you have to smack a bunch of ads on it to make it work. And so we need to be ethical consumers as well and vote with our dollars and also vote with our votes when it comes to government regulation.
Of course, yeah.
Because eventually, yeah, a lot of these dark patterns are going to go away. But the businesses that are choosing to be proactively ethical right now, like you should patronize them. And it's a whole nother podcast. But then it's like the whole like NFT blockchain discussion of in order to make things more ethical digitally, we need to create scarcity digitally so that you... like something's worth something because it's scarce. But yeah, we don't have to open that can of worms, especially
crazy, crazy world out there with the NFT bidding and so on. It's weird, both weird and exciting and daunting. I don't know how to call it. It's an exploratory space and I love it. It could go either up or down. I don't know, who knows? But I think the essential thing here is to recognize that digital products and tech in general is merely a tool for us to use to get on with our lives. Mm-hmm. In the same time, we hijack technology to just use it as a distraction tool, a tool for manipulation, a tool for informational war. Sometimes it's really weird. It almost sounds pathetic or too exaggerated, but it just got really real, at least in the pandemic and with the elections and you name it. Let's just make sure the tools that we're using are properly built and they actually improve our day-to-day work and we don't actually end up depending on broken things or things that we cannot rely on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like we really, as designers, you also can vote with where you work, right? Like work on a product that you're not measuring your success by daily usage, or you're measuring it by, hey, could they get their task done quickly, reliably, affordably, instead of working for companies that like, their success depends on hijacking your attention and flooding you with dopamine, we are coming up on time, but which is like the whole premise of that social dilemma thing. And I applaud the people like interviewed in that show saying, oh, this is bad. Oh, I am responsible for advertising on Facebook, but it's bad. And I'm like, okay, cool. Did you get rid of all the stock shares that you own in Facebook and all the money that you made from that? Like, I'm not going to get rid of it, but it's bad.
Yeah. And in the same time you boycott, I don't know, Uber, that uninstall Uber or quit Uber. I don't know, when the scandal reached the mass media and everyone was not using Uber anymore. Okay. I won't use it. So how come you're not doing that with, I don't know, other services like digital products?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. But if you haven't seen The Social Dilemma yet, which I think is in vogue, it still is popular, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people have seen it, recommended watching. But yeah, George, this has been a really awesome conversation. And thank you for going deep with me and waxing a little philosophical.
We got a little bit philosophical, didn't we?
Yeah.
This was a more, let's say, more metaphorical that we intended to. We usually talk about down to earth and pragmatic stuff, but this time I think we got just a little bit metaphorical, which is I think good.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. It's just I guess that I like talking about the philosophical why, because if we get too mired down in tactics, we don't get in touch with the principles that inform those tactics in the first place, right?
Yeah.
And then we get into virtue signaling and people implementing tactics in the name of ethics.
Yeah.
But they're actually just disrupting business and economies and stuff. And because sometimes when you implement like a more restrictive pattern, you're actually not helping the end user. You're actually making something more like slapping more legal text than what's needed on a UI to make it more ethical. But you actually just made it harder to use, which is unethical. Exactly. So when you come on the way of product design, we try to get into the nitty gritty nuance of why we do things. So thanks for going on the ride with me. George, is there anything else that you want to talk about? You could use this time to plug anything or draw attention to any projects you're working on or just any final thoughts and we'll wrap it up.
I would love for people listening to this podcast and this episode to just check out the resources that we're trying to gather in terms of ethical design methodology and what other companies are using as tools. So make sure to check out the website, the Instagram account, and so on. It's ethic.design, both all of the social media accounts and the website as well. So hopefully we'll get more traction with the involvement and possibly the contribution of the community to this, let's say, collection of resources and best practices, and hopefully raise more awareness and just be more mindful when it comes to your job and the responsibility that you have when you build something for other people to use.
Cool. George, again, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate the work you're doing. And yeah, like hopefully we could do a follow-up as your community and the business grows. So thanks for coming on the show. You have a good one.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for listening to The Way of Product Design. One quick favor, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your network, your friends, and hit that subscribe button on the show wherever you're listening to it. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I'm really excited to bring more awesome interviews and content your way. So keep listening, you won't be disappointed.